Predictions are dangerous.
We absolutely need more inventory.
The Fed doesn't actually have a lot of tools to regulate inflation.
That cash is dried up.
Wow, is my first thought, Bruce.
If both parties don't win, it doesn't happen.
The Real Look. Trending news.
G'day. Today's Wednesday, April 17th. I'm Bruce Hardy.
And I'm Chase Williams.
And this is the news you need to know. Well, Chase, a panel of judges has denied a request to fold the growing list of lawsuits targeting the real estate industry into one consolidated case, saying in its Friday order that a wave of recent settlements made it premature to issue an opinion on the matter. Some of the plaintiffs and defendants involved in lawsuits filed by home sellers in numerous court districts across the country had sought to roll the lawsuits into one district, though they didn't agree on which. And other plaintiffs and defendants opposed the request altogether. So the motion to consolidate was made in part to make litigating the sprawling list of cases more efficient, as attorneys for dozens of real estate companies defend their clients from accusations that real estate industry was operating illegally. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it makes sense, Bruce, in terms of like the reasoning why they would want to consolidate, because if you've been listening to this program for any length of time, it was even hard for us to keep track of how many lawsuits there were and where they were coming from and the difference in who was named in each lawsuit, all these different things, right? So for efficiency's sake, as you stated, and probably just, you know, simplification and maybe even this demonstration of strength, right? Like we're taking all these smaller ones and combining them into something bigger is attractive. When you read some of what the panel shared of why they made this decision, right? And one of the statements is the settlement may well resolve at least some claims in this litigation, if not many, the panel wrote. We cannot speculate on the number of parties and claims that will remain once this and any other settlements are approved. What I hear when I read that, Bruce, is they're thinking that a lot of the claims are going to be handled based on the current settlements that are moving toward, at least we think, approval. They've not been approved yet, but we have some dates coming up in May where some are anticipating approval. So that instead of centralizing them all, a lot of them could end up going away. They went on to say, after settlement proceedings conclude, and it becomes evident how many claims and parties still remain and the extent to which they overlap, if at all, it may be that formal centralization is needed, the order said. When I read that, I think, okay, the decision now is not to centralize, but it sounds like maybe this question might come back up again, right?
Well, I thought it was interesting. Michael Ketchmark, the lead attorney representing plaintiffs in the Sitzer Burnett case, told Inman on Friday that the ruling showed the importance of the recent settlements and it could actually push more brokerages to settle their own cases. He said, what the federal court did today was said because of these settlements, it doesn't look like right now there's a need for consolidation. It looks like this is headed towards responsible brokers and companies finding a way to settle with NAR and other corporate defendants. And if it plays out that way, there's not going to be a need to have a consolidation. I just think this is so funny. Ketchmark said that he was involved in active settlement talks with companies, though he declined to name them, citing confidentiality agreements. He called those who haven't yet settled holdouts, who are more likely to settle after Friday's ruling. I don't know, Chase, this, God, maybe it's me. I just feel like every time I hear this guy speak and whenever he's quoted, he is really just thinking about his money. It's responsible for all these companies to go and settle with him, right? Rather than be holdouts.
Yeah, the one individual on the planet that is set to benefit most from a settlement is hoping that more settle. Imagine that. Hard to believe, right, Bruce?
Oh my gosh, yeah. So fascinating. I just feel like this whole thing is being run by attorneys who are looking for self-enrichment. It is what it is. Nothing you and I can do about this. But yeah, I think we're going to move. I think ultimately the attorney's goal is to get all the companies to settle. And if that happens, then this thing just sort of goes away quietly. Well, Chase, cities with already high housing costs are seeing home values rise even faster during the spring housing market. And that's according to an analysis by Zillow. Seasonal home growth is highest in West Coast tech hubs as buyers compete for extremely limited inventory, with San Jose home values growing by 3.3% to an average, get this, of 1.6 million. Now, San Francisco, Seattle, San Diego, and Los Angeles followed with monthly value growth of 2% or more. What do you think of this?
Well, I mean, it just indicates, Bruce, the continued strength of home values, right, in lots of places across the country. Certainly, we're identifying some here that are already high in price and are still continuing to see appreciation. I mean, homes in San Jose have been spendy for a long, long time, and they just continue to go up, in large part, Bruce, due to low inventory. And that's actually a topic we haven't covered as often as sometimes we do recently, because inventory is kind of ticked upwards, although it's still really low from a month's perspective. And in some of these areas, like a San Jose or Seattle or San Francisco, where home values are already so high, and you have some of these homeowners that are quote unquote locked in to the low interest rates that they have, I think oftentimes you're seeing even lower inventory than some of the other areas of the country. Sometimes these are also hard places to build a lot of new houses, given the red tape, the policies on infill and the available land for builders, et cetera. So you have additional pressure on the amount of inventory available. And what that causes, of course, is, you know, low supply and more demand. You have an uptick in prices. And although it's a lot less dramatic in it as an uptick than we saw maybe in years past, it continues to climb.
Yeah, I think it also, I agree with you, the inventory is a big piece to that. And there's no doubt that there are people who are rate locked there who just, there's no alternative for them to move if it's a discretionary move. Although I will say what it also says to me, Chase, all of these cities are all tech hubs. It speaks to the strength of the tech industry, right? I mean, when you look at the stock market, they call them the Magnificent Seven, which are the all big tech companies. And what we know is a lot of those people make more money than the median income. I think what this does is it puts pressure on everybody else who's not in one of those high paying jobs, because those people are really who are driving these values up. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. It's so competitive. And how long does this continue before we see a correction?
Great question, Bruce. And the article also notes that there's some similarities to these high-priced tech hubs to even some of the Midwestern cities that are not high tech or even high priced. And that is what you mentioned, which is the competition. And one of the measures of that is how quickly these homes are selling. So for example, listings in Seattle, the median days from listed on the market to going pending is 6. You compare that to Chicago, quite a different city. The median days of going pending is 7. And then Detroit, actually it was 7 in Chicago and Detroit, and then it was 5 in St. Louis, right? So that is the level of competition that we're still experiencing in certain areas. And so, you know, if you're a buyer, and good for you, it's always a good time to buy the right piece of real estate, as Gary Keller would tell us. Just be prepared that it's still a very competitive environment, depending on exactly where you're at and the price point at which you're shopping in.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, I'm feeling that acutely because my youngest daughter and her husband are looking to buy a house in the Seattle market, and it is ferocious. As a real estate professional, right, what we need to look at are what are the opportunities of finding inventory that's actually not even on the market yet, which, by the way, I was able to help my daughter do. So we're in the negotiation phase now where she's getting to negotiate on a property that's not yet on the market, so nobody else knows about it. You got to do whatever you got to do, right, to get into a market like this. Well, gosh, Chase, it seems like it's lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. This is a different one than what we've normally been talking about. And that is Open Door will pay nearly $62 million in refunds to tens of thousands of home sellers. And it's allegedly deceptive advertising under a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission. And that's according to an FTC announcement. Now, starting today, the federal agency is sending checks to 54,689 consumers, it says, were deceived by advertising and marketing claims made by the iBuyer. The median refund amount people who sold their home to Opendoor are receiving is $1,024, and that's according to the FTC website. What thinks you of this one?
Well, again, Bruce, just, you know, it's always interesting to me when we can hoodwink 54,689 home sellers, or at least that's the claim, right? And so it's always kind of fascinating to me to think that that amount of people didn't understand the method with which they were using to sell their home, to open door rather than through what they would call the traditional process, and the advantages and disadvantages of that process. Because frankly, Bruce, if you're selling to one buyer and you're not exposing your home to the world, you would anticipate that there's a chance that maybe you get less for that house. Again, you and I know, and so do those sellers, by the way, that the reason for that is for ease of transaction or speed of transaction. If you want it to be faster and easier, you should probably expect to take a little less. If you don't mind the time and the energy that goes into it, and you want to expose your home to the whole world, maybe you can expect a little more, and it depends. But when you're working with one buyer versus all the buyers, I find it hard to believe that anyone was fooled. Now, I haven't looked deep enough to know exactly what their marketing practices were. Apparently, the FTC has, and it's going to cost them $62 million, however they were saying it, regardless of how I feel. But, you know, it's always interesting when we have these sorts of, you know, blanket claims and decisions where everyone was somehow harmed. I just don't know that I can get on board with that.
You know, mate, I agree with you. It's sort of like people outside of our industry look at our industry and think that we're all just a big organized crime syndicate. Because according to the FTC's August 2022 complaint, Open Door cheated home sellers by tricking them into thinking that they could make more money selling their home to Open Door than on the open market using the traditional sales process, while saving them money on costs. In reality, the FTC said, most people who sold to Open Door made thousands of dollars less than they would have made selling their homes using the traditional process, and many paid more in costs than what sellers typically pay. Under a final administrative order, Open Door agreed to pay monetary relief and stop its deceptive practices. Again, if we look back at this whole Sitzer-Burnett case versus this claim here, right? The Sitzer-Burnett says we're artificially, the traditional system that we've been running for 100 years in this country is deceiving the sellers and they're paying too much. And then, okay, you get a disruptor like Open Door come in, and now the FTC is saying is people would have made more money and had less costs if they'd used a traditional real estate route. So I don't know. I can't keep up.
Yeah. So the traditional, which is what we got sued over, is now preferred. I can't keep up either, Bruce. And, you know, I feel for Open Door in this particular regard, simply because you can hear in their, even their announcements, just the strain and the stress that they're looking forward to moving past. They said, while we strongly disagree with the FTC's allegations, our decision to settle with the commission will allow us to resolve the matter and focus on helping consumers buy, sell, and move with simplicity, certainty, and speed. They later said, we are pleased to put this matter behind us. And I think oftentimes, Bruce, that's what these attorneys are counting on, frankly. Regardless of whether the claim is even true or accurate, they say, hey, we're going to wear these companies down and just, you know, tie up all their time, energy, and their money, by the way, by hiring attorneys to defend this until we can get some sort of settlement out of them. And you and I have talked about this a little bit offline, Bruce. I think that the number of lawsuits and the ridiculousness of some of these claims just illustrates the need for reform on just the court process and who you can sue and who's responsible for the costs. Because if we let this thing get away from us, it'd be hard to even walk around on the planet and not be sued for something you didn't do, just because somebody thinks they can get a buck out of it. And that's a real problem.
Well, and we know it's the attorneys who are making the bucks because, you know, in this $62 million settlement, on a state-by-state basis, the biggest chunk of money, $14.2 million, will go to 13,103 home sellers in Texas who actually receive a median refund of $981. Woo! And then, of course, in Arizona, where Open Door first began buying and reselling homes, 8,003 home sellers will receive a total of $9.2 million with a median refund of $1,046. And then in Florida, 6,201 home sellers will get a combined $6.8 million. That equates to a median refund of $1,023. And I have to say, I just think it's so funny because FTC says home sellers who receive checks should cash them within 90 days.
Great advice.
Oh, my gosh. United States property investors are putting the pedal to the metal and feeling optimistic despite a turbulent housing market, and that's according to a pair of reports. The share of homes purchased by investors reached a new high in the fourth quarter of 2023, and investor sentiment remains relatively high heading into the spring housing market. In October, November, and December, the share of single-family homes purchased by investors was 28%. 27.3% and then 28.7% respectively. And that's according to a report released this week by CoreLogic. And that beats out the previous all-time high share of 28.3%, which was recorded in February of 2022. Now, by the way, the share of purchases made by investors could exceed 30% in 2024, is at least what the report posits. What do you think of this, Chase?
Well, Bruce, it's not surprising, but I'll tell you why. I think number one, in the industry, we typically think of home buyers that are purchasing for use, right? Primary residence or otherwise, tend to operate with a lot of emotion, right? And as you would anticipate, you would. You're going to live in this house. You're going to raise your family there. Maybe it's a second home that you plan to enjoy and create memories in. So we always go into those situations with a little bit more emotion. And we tend to think of investors as thinking very logically about an investment, right? And we would suggest that they do. It's driven by the numbers themselves, their belief in the long-term appreciation of value of that investment, the safety of that investment, and reducing risk. Those are the logical conversations and thoughts that typically go through the investor's mind. The reason why I say, you know, it's not surprising is there's a strong belief, Bruce, with these investors that real estate is still a really safe and a really great asset to invest in long term. And so they're demonstrating that not only with their confidence, but with their action, right?
Absolutely. And again, you know, the fact that they're doing it in what would be perceived as a high interest rate market. Again, you know, we talk about this a lot, Chase, how much equity is tied up in housing today, right? And what we know about investors is, you know, having that equity tied up, sitting there, not really doing anything is actually a detriment. And they're the ones more likely to unlock that equity and use that to go and grow more, right? Go and invest in more real estate. So I think it's pretty fascinating, right, that we're seeing between 70 and 80,000 purchases per month. And by the way, when we talk about these investors, these aren't just your big corporate Wall Street types.
Right.
Right. A lot of these are mom and pops.
Most.
Right. Most of them. Small investors. And I find what's interesting is that, so even though that's grown, what we're seeing is the number of homes purchased by owner occupants has shrunk by about 100,000 homes per month to where they were prior to 2022. Yeah, I think this is really interesting. I think it's a validation of that real estate's a good investment. And again, you know, we talk about, you look at the high net worth individuals in this country, and over the last 12 months, we've seen a lot of them pull their money out of equities and put it into cash and or real estate.
Yep.
Right. And I think that there are lessons to be learned by watching those that have the money. To me, that's a sort of an indicator of where we're going. And I think it would be wise for us to all look at that.
Agreed, Bruce. And there's also something not mentioned in the article that in part, I think, helps drive investors into real estate over the last several years and going forward. And that is the advantages on the tax side of things. So when you're looking at interest rates and values, that's the math that you start with, because you still want to make a great investment. But an investor looks a little further into the math and says, okay, if that makes this a good investment, the tax advantages that come along with it could make it a great investment, right? And so there are some pretty significant tax advantages available when you buy the right real estate and you understand those tax advantages, things like cost segregation, accelerated depreciation as an example. And as a matter of fact, there's some legislation working its way through the House and Senate that would restore some of those advantages back to amounts that we haven't seen in a couple of years for the next several years. So a lot of people aren't paying that much attention to those type of things. And frankly, because they haven't needed to, but investors are always looking for the edge, if you will. That's why they're investors. Sometimes we tend to somehow think that they're doing something wrong or cheating the system, but they're actually not. They're just paying close attention to where they can get a percentage here, a percentage there of advantage. That's the job of an investor, right? And so that's probably a factor playing into the amount of people deciding that real estate, along with the tax advantages it brings, is still a great investment.
Well, that's the news you need to know. Don't miss this Friday's Northern Lights episode, where we'll interview Todd Dutzman with Keller Williams North Sound in Marysville, Washington. Thanks again for tuning in with us on The Real Look. This podcast is produced by Marissa Frost. Visit kwnwr.com to access the show notes from today's episode. Head over to Apple, Google, or Spotify, or really any major streaming platform to subscribe, and don't forget to leave us a review. Thanks again for listening to The Real Look.